Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is returning guest, Anthony Milevsky. He's a commodities financier and chairman of Conic Metals. How are you today, Anthony?
Great. Hey, thanks a lot for having me back. I always enjoy being on the show.
We're happy to have you back. One thing that we were talking about before the call is something that you're finding interesting right now and something that not a lot of people are talking about. So tell us a little bit more about carbon and why it's going to be really important going forward.
Yeah, you know, I think most of the market is talking about gold right now, and as it should be. I think gold is interesting, but you know, I'm always looking for new ideas and you know, maybe the next thing. And the carbon market is fascinating. And you know, if you look at what's happening in mining with ESG and a growing global awareness around, you know, our carbon footprints and the impact that the commodities we consume have on the environment, I don't think you can overlook the carbon markets. And, you know, it's a really complex and interesting market, and I think ripe for investment from all commodities investors. And, you know, today that market is really a regulated market and a voluntary market, but yeah, it's fascinating.
How would one go about investing in that? And tell us a little bit about what ESG is as well.
Sure. So I think, first of all, you have to kind of think about, you know, yourself as a Canadian or an American and kind of think about what your carbon footprint is. And, you know, and on average, if you're an American, it's about 16 metric tons of carbon a year. So to put that in perspective, that's about 5 football fields. Think about that. 5 football fields of mature trees worth of carbon footprint a year. That's just you. You multiply that across your household and then across your life, and you're talking about a massive impact that you're, you know, having on the earth and on our environment. And that density, of course, changes a little bit. You know, for Canadians, maybe it's closer to 15 and a half metric tons annually. And so how do you invest in that? And, you know, there are kind of a couple markets. There's the regulated markets. If you think about those markets, you've got the EU cap and trade programs. You've got a program in California. You've got REGIs in the Northeast. You've got, you know, a market up in Canada. And this is not a small market. The carbon markets today are something like $250 billion. Think about that annually. So these are big markets. To trade those markets, by and large, you need to have an account at a big bank, a Morgan Stanley or someone like that, and trade derivatives. So it's kind of a challenging market to access. The other market, which I actually find far more interesting, although it's a lot smaller today, is the voluntary market. It's probably 5 times smaller than the regulated market. And that's the market where, you know, you get on an Air Canada, or you used to get on an Air Canada flight, and you know, you click the box, and for $27 you offset your footprint. Like, those credits have to come from somewhere, and that's the voluntary market. And if you kind of think about these markets and what's happening in the regulated market, what's happening is it's costing you as an emitter, as a producer of carbon, it's costing you something to pollute, right? Like, that's the idea. And as it costs more and more to pollute, you either change your technology, you change your process, or you pass that through to consumers and they have to pay more for that good or service, which is costing to pollute. And so the idea is that by cap and trade, you will either change technology or consumption patterns because it's costing more to pollute. Now, that's the regulated market. I think the voluntary market is more really around awareness, although it's also costing more and more to pollute with time. And so with coronavirus, you know, we had Greta last year, but with coronavirus today, what we're seeing is air is cleaned up globally in major cities, and people are going to demand a change in policy around emissions. And so you have this whole thing accelerating. And if I look at our space in mining, you know, think about what you do with the mine. You go and you clear cut down this huge area, you dig a hole, you pile dirt up, you create dust. And so you have a really large carbon footprint, and there are already calls to change that. But I think going forward, you're going to see every single mining company who's doing any physical activity have the desire and probably requirement to offset the carbon footprint. And, you know, that dovetails into ESG, which is something, you know, separate and apart from carbon and carbon credits. but it's, of course, carbon credits are a component of ESG. And ESG is really a way of thinking about having, you know, environmental social governance inside of companies. And, you know, companies historically have really only been driven for profit, but I think this ESG movement is saying you have to put value on other things, and that's diversity, and that's, you know, caring for the environment. And if we look at the media around mining over the last 6 months, I think you can see that's a major topic that's come out, and carbon credits is just sort of a subset of that topic. ESG is a topic unto itself around corporate governance and a bunch of different issues.
Absolutely. So as we're talking about the carbon footprint of mining, it made me think they're also building or burning a lot of diesel fuel for that at the same time. And going through a couple of your interviews in research for this one, at one point you were talking about a type of mine that ended up being carbon neutral or carbon negative. Is that something that is going to start really gaining a lot of popularity and something that shareholders are going to start looking at?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that being carbon neutral is going to be part of every pitch deck eventually. And different mines can achieve that in different ways. You know, obviously, sometimes tailings are able to have material that sequesters carbon. Other times, you know, offsets can be done through planting of forests, or, you know, there's a bunch of different ways you could achieve that. And it would really be unique to each geology and location. But I do think if you're a Tesla or a battery maker or automaker and you're buying products, basic materials that go into your vehicle, I think as ESG develops and carbon scores develop, that look through all the way back to the basic materials is going to become more transparent, and it's going to be more relevant because your production of nickel or copper or whatever it is going to be part of that score over time. And so from my perspective, although we're on the very front end of it, this is a wave that's absolutely going to be a component of every mine and every disclosure over time, like that's going to be rolled into the disclosure. And I think to bring the two together, the carbon footprint and that kind of that whole thing will be rolled into the ESG framework. And so the ESG framework will put forward this whole framework, and a component of that framework will be carbon itself. And so, you know, carbon as an asset class to invest in for me is highly interesting because you have all these goals to achieve carbon neutral, carbon negative footprints across all industries, you know, not just the mining industry. And you've got the regulated markets where you can speculate on where that's going. But you also have, and Goldman Sachs put out a great note earlier this week on the voluntary markets, you also have the potential for businesses who are unregulated to be proactive in going out and creating these carbon credits. So, you know, we're looking at a couple of different ways to access those voluntary markets and potentially bring a product to market even later this year.
So for people that are interested in trying to understand and learn more about this, what are some good resources that you know of on where to find more information about something that seems quite on the low end of exposure right now?
Yeah, so interestingly, as I said, you know, the carbon market itself is quite large. You know, in 2019, it was like $220 billion. So there are a huge number of NGOs out there, you know, the Global Carbon Project, you know, and environmental groups producing research about carbon. But I have to tell you, frankly, the Goldman Sachs note later this week was fantastic. Morgan Stanley's put out research. I mean, if anyone reaches out to me on Twitter, happy to provide you with those notes. So there is plenty of information. It's just that historically, that space has been dominated either in the regulated market by cap and trade, or frankly in the voluntary market by NGOs. And so investors haven't really focused on environmental commodities in the way that I think they are going forward, especially as the ESG movement rolls out and demands more attention being paid to this part of it. So I think this to me is one of the most exciting markets I've looked at in a long time. And I think it's going to be relevant for mining because it's going to be a critical part of disclosure. And frankly, the cost the cost of building a mine is going to change, because a mine that's carbon neutral and marginal today might become actually economic in the future compared to something that's economic today but has a really large carbon footprint. So it can definitely change the economics of mines going forward as well, as people are more conscious of the environment.
That's really interesting, Anthony. Something that just struck me as you're saying about the cost of mines, we know that one of the larger costs of mining and setting up a mine are nickel mines. So could we see that really dramatically affecting that, or could it be a small portion of what those mines are going to cost to actually set up?
Well, like take the Turnagain project in British Columbia, you know, just because of the geology, you know, there's the opportunity there to have a carbon neutral mine where the tailings sequester carbon. So that's really not factored into anyone's economics today. It's not something the market is focused on. But that could dramatically change, and I believe is one of the really interesting parts of that project, is that that is a part of the economics which isn't built in today. But as we go forward and look forward, and new mines being built are required to give thought to the carbon footprint, it completely will change the economics of that project. When I look at some of the other nickel projects which have such large capex, generally speaking, adding one more layer of capex is just going to mean that less nickel projects are economic sooner, and so it probably pronounces the squeeze on nickel that's going to take place in the coming years as EVs are adopted and that nickel-rich battery is really the global leader for electric vehicles.
As we're talking about nickel, let's get some of your thoughts on the nickel sector. You were saying that the demand for nickel has been kicked down the road a little bit with basically what's happened in the larger economy as a whole, because if you don't have money, you can't buy a car, as you were saying, right?
Yeah, no. So look, it's a base metal. At the end of the day, nickel and copper are both base metals. And so, you know, we've had one of the biggest shocks to the global economy in modern history. And if you just lost your job, you don't need to go buy a new car. You can make do with what you've got. If you've got one, you can have it fixed. So, you know, in my mind, automobile sales globally across the board will be down, right? Maybe there'll be some specialty things like trucks or something that won't be down. But by and large, if people aren't feeling great about the prospects, they're not going to go buy a new car. So to me, that just defers the EV story. I still believe it's inevitable, but with car demand potentially being down, at least in the near term, now stimulus and different things might change that. To me, one of the key aspects of the nickel story was a new demand entrant in the form of battery demand. Nickel-rich battery demand was going to be one of the things that puts huge pressure on the nickel price. I think that's probably delayed at a minimum of a year, you know, maybe a couple of years. And the determining factor in that delay is just going to be the global economy and the purchase of automobiles. What we've seen is even during coronavirus, the mix of new car sales has actually slanted towards electric vehicles. So electric vehicles on a relative basis are gaining ground against, you know, ICE cars, but overall numbers and sales are down. So that's just going to be a function of the global economy. And I still think that, you know, with every commodity, whenever you have a moment of tension where the price is going to explode, the longer you go without experiencing it, the more dramatic it is. So right now, good luck trying to go raise enough money to build a new nickel mine. Like, I don't think you can do that. I don't think anyone can do that right now at this moment. And so what that means, and it can take years, and it does take years to build a mine. So no new mines are being built. And so, you know, when you delay the prospect of EVs really changing the nickel dynamic, you also delay the building of any new mines. And so I think what ends up happening is the squeeze that comes, and mind you, it's been pushed out. When that squeeze comes, it will probably be more pronounced and more dramatic. So that's just sort of one of the realities of commodities. And probably lithium is the same. You know, that's all part of the same story, lithium, nickel, cobalt. And, you know, it's going to be or have been delayed now with a change in demand for the underlying product, namely electric vehicles.
What are some of the other concerns around cobalt? I know that ethically sourcing cobalt, especially for electric vehicle manufacturers that are under the scrutiny of the general public, they've had a lot of attention brought to mining cobalt out of the Congo. Are there other good sources of cobalt, and what are some of the other considerations for that market?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a market. It sort of has the same path as nickel there, and I think in the last maybe 2 or 3 weeks, Tesla has signed a deal with Glencore to receive cobalt out of the Congo. So, you know, you have Tesla who announces a few months ago, oh, we're going to eliminate cobalt from our batteries, and here they are signing a cobalt deal. So in a way, it's a type of manipulation, and it's sort of dishonest, I think, because it harms this future supply, which maybe is their intention. I have no idea. But so with the signing of that deal, what you're seeing is the future supply of cobalt is slowly being locked up into these longer term contracts. And it does mean that when this EV wave hits that tipping point, cobalt is going to experience dramatic gains as well. But once again, that's, you know, pushed out. And I think it's a big tell that Tesla went ahead and did a deal with Glencore, because, you know, they had been advertising a cobalt free battery. Clearly that battery, if it exists, is not going to be used in any of the big North American markets or European markets. Otherwise, they wouldn't have just locked up cobalt supply from Glencore.
Interesting. I think one of the other things that should be getting some attention right now is it's in a way hated, because it's kind of sitting to the side as global demand for it has subsided during the lockdowns and the pandemic, is copper. Give us some of your thoughts on copper right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, copper, I've been bullish on copper next year for the last 5 years. In other words, I've been wrong. I thought copper was going to have its moment sooner than it's had it. I think one of the big things that could surprise everyone is a Chinese stimulus plan that included copper, or, you know, dramatic infrastructure plans in the West as a way of trying to stimulate economies, would combine with a weaker dollar, which we're already seeing, I think would really put copper on a rocket ship. And no one of us control that, because that's going to be driven by government policy. But I think it's very possible, and maybe even plausible, that that's going to happen in the next 12 months, because governments are going to find that small businesses have gone out of business, and there's a lot of people hurting in the middle class, and they're going to think about ways and search for ways to create jobs. And rightly or wrongly, I believe infrastructure spending is going to be one of those ways, and that's going to be really bullish for copper. And so copper is one of these ones where you might have to wait, but at some moment, with all this kind of fiscal, you know, animal spirits going on, you know, copper is going to catch a bid. And it might get it from two ways, a weaker U.S. dollar and infrastructure spend.
Interesting. How about sharing with us some of your COVID-19 reading list?
You know, I read this really great book, The Bonanza King, about gold. You know, I had a friend of a friend gave it to me. You know, I thought it was good. I read one called The Diamond about diamonds in Australia. That was kind of interesting. Bad Blood was interesting. You know, a little bit of a scandal about, I don't know if you've read it, about blood and testing in Silicon Valley. And then, you know, I read one that's been around for a while that I really liked. It's called Against the Gods. And, you know, it's really about the story of risk and about kind of walking through statistics and how, you know, in the beginning, like, ship makers would think about risk. And I thought it's fascinating. I mean, I think it's probably a 10-year-old book, but it was really good. And then one more, I've had a lot of time, A Brief History of China. You know, this is really the Chinese century. And so kind of learning more about Chinese history, which I have to say, I don't know enough about.
I can personally vouch for The Bonanza King, and the audiobook is excellent as well, because it's read by a guy with an Irish accent, so it makes it a little bit more authentic.
That's great. Yeah, no, it was good. I have not heard the audiobook, but I think I'm going to reread The Big Score. You know, it's kind of fun. We're starting to have more books now. You know, there's another one, which I haven't started, that someone gave me, Never Rest on Your Oars. So it's another one kind of along those lines. It's fun to have a few more books now in the mining industry than we've had.
Absolutely. Anything else you'd like to mention as we wrap up, Anthony?
No, look, I appreciate the time. Like I said, I think it's worth having a look at the carbon markets and thinking about it, because it's going to impact. It's going to be interesting as an investment, like really interesting, but also it's going to impact mining. And I don't think people have really focused on that yet. ESG is a big theme for mining, and that's just going to continue to get bigger. You know, I think the ESG theme, you know, we didn't touch on this, we're running out of time, but you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and just the need to include more people in the mining industry. And that's not just women, which is a major one. I mean, you know, half the world is women. Like, I can tell you half the world isn't women in mining. I mean, not just women, but I think also reach out and have a more diverse group of executives out there. That's also a major global theme, and it's going to come to mining. And I think all of us should think about that. As a board member of a number of boards, I think it's something that I'm going to push, as, you know, really thinking about diversity in a lot of different ways. It's something we've not done well. So, you know, there's a lot of changes coming to mining that are soft changes. They're not, you know, not maybe the ones that you would have thought about a year or two ago, but they're here now, and we got to think about embracing them, but also how they're going to impact our investment strategies.
So as the chairman of Conic Metals, how do you go about thinking, let's say, including a more diverse group of people? Do you think that there's a, let's say, a lack of interest from, just take as an example, a good number of women or any other group that you would like to include on a board?
So I think there's a bunch of different levels. I mean, there's a whole conversation. There's a bunch of different levels of inclusion. You know, I think the first one is a mining company. If you are a mining company, I think you need to include people locally. Like, that's a level of inclusion, right? Like, you need to include communities. So that's like one level of inclusion. And then within those communities, you need to include a diverse range of viewpoints and people, right? And that would be very specific to country and, you know, time and place. So then there's that kind of part of it. And then if you come back to kind of the board level, and, you know, I think mining, it's historically kind of been a good old boys network, and probably as a community and as a group, we have not done a great job of mentoring women and helping women to be included, right? Like, I don't know, I don't have any statistics on that, but that would just be my gut feeling. And so I think the conversations that have to happen on directors are, how do we, you know, not only identify suitable candidates, right, like whoever they might be, but also make sure that everyone who's on that board is included, and you know, maybe in an industry that was a good old boys industry and dominated by different types of, you know, activities, you know, you got to rethink that and do things and conduct ourselves in a way that's inclusive of everyone. Not just gender diversity, but racial diversity. And I believe firmly that this is changing, and it's changing globally. And we need to start to be, if we're not aware of these issues, which I think everyone is aware now or should be, we need to think about, you know, how do we take this awareness and apply it to our boards and our management teams, because it needs to be done. It's time, right? And so I think for me, it's really just kind of learning and trying to understand, because I don't have the answer. I don't kind of know what the answer is or have a silver bullet. And so I'm at the point of just listening to directors and trying to understand, you know, what the best way forward is, but certainly inclusion and offering opportunities to people is a first and important step.
It sounds like you're really on the cutting edge of what's coming for the future of mining and just companies in general.
Well, we're trying. So, look, I appreciate it once again. I appreciate you having me on. Love to be on again. And you got any follow up? Feel free to reach out from your listeners, or they can get me on Twitter.
Absolutely. Thanks, Anthony.
Cheers.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?